Hello, welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. It's the Caramel Kid relocated. Where are you, Caramel?
What? I'm good. Relocated, yeah. I'm in Basingstoke. Obviously, I had to go to Reagan's wedding.
Oh, of course you did. Yeah. Long time listener.
I was going to go as a pencil, but I think Big Ben's taking over the best fancy dress costume.
So you're as Big Ben then?
Yeah. Because remember, got stuck under the Blooming Bridge in Marathon, didn't he?
Yeah. So yeah, perfect. Was it a good day? Good wedding?
Yeah, it was good. Obviously. And party, dancing and stuff. So yeah, it's all good.
Did you stay off the special sauce?
Special sauce? What sauce?
Well, you know, a bit of the champagne, a bit of the Prosecco, all that sort of thing.
Nah. Remember, I'm a professional driver.
You get paid for taking corners. You ain't taking those.
I was on designated. I was driving people home, though.
Oh, okay.
Then they could drink, so that was fine.
So the most important
thing.
What
about you?
I was going to say, the most important question about a wedding is, what was the spread like?
Spread? Surprisingly, because obviously, I don't want to get racial,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But usually, you know, like, well, I might went in, obviously, because I only came to the evening.
Yeah.
You get, like, sausage or chicken and stuff. Reagan came out with loads of Indian food.
Hey.
And I was like, well, that's a bit of a surprise. And it was, like, really good and tasty. So, yeah.
You can always tell an athlete because he's standing right by the buffet and he never leaves all night.
No, the athletes were in for the food first. It was really funny. But when the food is sitting there,
yeah,
and people can have it, no one goes for it because they don't know if you can have it or not.
I'm always first there, man. I want to help everybody. That's it. You're the man. You're the man that's helping everybody out. You're breaking down boundaries.
One person sitting down eating, the queue goes around the room.
Yeah. We're kindred spirits, Jermaine, me and you. We're always first at the buffet. But we're helping people. We're not being greedy. We're helping people, for God's sake. Yeah.
That's why you only run 2:30 for the marathon.
Like, I hate going to hotels, right? I do like it. I don't being in a hotel is quite fun. But what I don't like about it is the buffet breakfast, because I feel a responsibility to eat all of the food. Because I think if I don't eat it, that's going to go in the bin, and I'm not having that. So I've got to go and eat everything on this plate. So yeah,
my mentality is I need to get my money's worth. It's like, this hotel is costing me so much, yeah. But I was thinking, I've got to eat my money's worth and take extra for lunch.
Yeah. So if you're hearing this, this first 5 minutes of this recording, don't let me and Jermaine near a buffet. Don't invite us to a party because we're going to eat your buffet out. One final thing about buffets, right? It was at my wedding, we had a big buffet. And the next morning, I came there and we had to go and clear up. And the amount of food that was left, and all of it, I thought, oh, we can save that. That's fine, I can save that. There was one whole, basically big, packet of clotted cream. And I thought, of all the things that are sitting on this table that are going to go off in the next 24 hours, this is it. So I didn't want to waste it, so I just drank the whole thing of clotted cream.
Oh, man.
It was delicious. My wedding morning, I was covered in cream.
You should have took it to the bedroom and say, babe, I'm spicing things up.
So anyway, that's buffets and me, buffets and you. Yeah, anyway. But you doing all right? You're back on the job?
What have you been doing this weekend?
This weekend, yeah. I'm in the land. We're talking together on Monday morning. Obviously, in the UK, you got a bank holiday today. You don't get that in the Netherlands. But they did have we had some parties yesterday because it's Liberation Day. So obviously, the Nazis come over here. They took over. And then we have a big celebration for when they kick the Nazis out. So it's a bigger deal, I think, than Liberation Day. So that we had parties this weekend. And I've just discovered a running buggy. It's an out and about. So I've been running about with Greta. Me and the wife have been doing some miles. Not very far, but we've been out running with the running buggy. So my new regime is set.
Is it the one with three wheels?
It's three wheels. They're big. Yeah, it doesn't, it's quite sturdy. I actually think I could run fast with this. So yeah, I don't know if Greta's very excited about it.
The only thing you lose is your arm motion when you're running with a buggy.
Yeah, I keep having to swap over, but that's not very good. And I've been watching videos back of me running the London Marathon, and I noticed I've still got this really annoying thing where my left shoulder's up and my right shoulder's down. And so I've got mechanically something's wrong. But then when I start running, I can't push with my left hand. This is boring for the listeners, but I've got to sort my body out. It's all a mess. I'm all over the place, but hey.
Right.
But I'm already been thinking about my next challenge, next running challenge. And I'm thinking about trying to... I think we spoke a bit about it last time, but I'm going to go back to cross-country and mountain running and see how that goes. And getting a gym membership, getting down the treadmill, putting up on the highest incline I can, running up that for half an hour. So that should be fun. And yeah, just getting back to doing a bit more gym stuff, because I think like that mechanically, if I look at the photos of me at the end of the marathon, the way my legs were collapsing in, I know it's a marathon, so you're tired anyway, but I was a bit of a mess. So I think if I'm going to have another go at the marathon, I've got to try and spend more time in the gym and less time running, I think, and get much more strong. So that is my plan for the next few weeks. What about you? You've been working?
I had before the weekend, and obviously, so, like, little story before, obviously, I came.
Yeah.
Driving along, and the old lady with a sort of Zimmer frame basket thing.
Yeah.
You know, where you put the food in, that trolley.
Yeah.
Four wheels. I pull in and she goes, can you lower the bus? So I lowered the bus and she still couldn't get on.
Yeah.
I'm like, and then there was no one around to help her. I was like, bloody hell. Yeah. I'm going to have to do the good thing here and get out and help her. Right?
Yeah.
So I get out and then I go to pick it up and she goes, oh, be careful, it's heavy.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. And I grab it. So the bars at the front are like, you know, like the clothes hanger bars, those thin little rods.
Yeah.
So I grab it in the middle and then grab the handle. I'm pull it up and I just pull one of the bars straight off. It's like shit. So I put the bar in the basket and grab it from the put it on.
Yeah.
And then she was so mad that I broke her basket, she was like kissing her teeth and stuff and she buzzed in and walked past. I said, bloody, I said, I've just done you a favour and I'm getting grief.
That poor little, she had that thing since the 1940s, Jermaine. She's got to go and buy a new one. Yeah.
But it was so heavy. It must have been like 50 kg worth of shopping in there.
These old people, right, they have to get ready for the for nuclear war. So they've got to get their tins in.
They're getting ready for Brexit.
My nan used to have like a whole like cellar full of tins and food because she was worried about one day if she couldn't get out and get it. So yeah.
Tins is a funny one. My mum is the same thing. Tins, yeah. They love tins, mate.
Tins is disgusting, yeah. But anyway, that's what happens. It happens to us all, unfortunately. We shouldn't laugh, but yeah, anyway. But
this show is about what?
Well, this show, before we go any further, we should sort of say, like, last week's show was a bit of a short one. We talked about London Marathon. I was so tired. I'd run the marathon. My baby had kept me up all night. We forgot to mention, we got the numbers wrong. You were closer than we thought. You were 4-3, weren't you?
It was 4-3, yeah.
Yeah.
I was still up pouting because I lost. Yeah. And then I was figuring out I didn't lose as bad.
No, okay. For anyone who's new to the show, basically we had a London Marathon predictions contest and we decided various different categories. Jermaine got 3 right, I got 4 right, so I am technically winning, which means the prize or the forfeit is you've got to go dressed up fancy dress and set a world record at a race at the end of summer.
Whoa. Yeah. Let's hold back on the world record part.
Yeah, okay. You've at least got to go fancy dress.
Really bad suit. If you have a really bad suit.
So we've got to decide that. If you want to suggest anything, feel free to suggest on the old Twitter. Tag us in at Let's Get Running. But Jermaine...
Yeah, 10K would be fine. I think I can wing a 10K.
Okay.
I did a park run. I did the Basingstoke Park Run Saturday and that was hard work.
Right, what did you run? Spill the beans?
Oh boy, I ran 18 minutes home. I was back with the joggers.
Oh. It's not bad though, man, if you haven't run that much. We'll get that down to 15.
Yeah.
So give us your suggestions on Jermaine's outfit. We have to try and find an interesting outfit he can run 10K in. And we've got to try and commit to a race, haven't we, end of the summer?
Yeah. We'll do that. And then if it's got, you can be the sidekick of the outfit.
Okay. Yeah. We were thinking about a donkey, so
we could do Black Man and Robin or something.
But we forgot loads of other details about the race. But like, I didn't notice some performances like that. The Sinead Dive Diva, who's she's Irish born, but she's Australian. She runs over in Australia. She's part of Melbourne Track Club. So I think she may train with Charlotte Purdue, but she ran 2:24. She's only been running for, I think, 9 years. She's 42, 2 kids. Amazing performance. I think she's one of the top runners this year. Incredible run from her. We didn't notice that one.
That's good. Yeah.
And we failed to mention, you know, the guys in second and third in the men's race. It was Mozinek Geremu, who was, I think it was the second fastest this year, like 2:03, really quick time. I think he's done a few. He was second at Chicago, I think, maybe behind Mo. Maybe we'll have to check that out.
They both got second and third, both definitely got PBs.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's funny, that guy that came third, he called Mul Yeshin. So when I was out in Ethiopia, I bumped into Mul on the trails, and we had a chat, and we ran a bit with each other for a bit. He's such a lovely bloke, right? And then I got to Amsterdam 6 months later, and I went up to him and I said, "Oh, hello, Mu. How are you? How are you doing?" And he completely blanked me, completely forgot.
And yeah, he was just another white person to him, isn't
he? Exactly. Yeah. He did not care. To be fair, he then realised, and he was like, "Oh, yeah, okay." But he didn't really remember me. But anyway, but he's a nice fella. I like him more. He's good. And his record, he just every marathon he goes in, he'll come like podium, or he'll come around podium if he finishes. He's a really good athlete. He's underratedly good. So yeah, good performances that we failed to take in notice of. But to be fair to us, we were tired. We had the dog there.
Well, you were. The funny thing, because after we did the show,
Sean
had to meet someone.
Yeah.
And I was walking down the road, and Sean went down the first road he thought was the road he's. Yeah. And I carried on running, and Sean caught me up and goes, "Oh, I took the wrong road." And then he was running down the road, because now he was late, and you just seen him. He was running like a cowboy with like a broomstick up his bum. It was so funny.
Oh, I was struggling. I'd had about 3 hours sleep. I'd run a marathon, I had about 3 hours sleep, and I was, oh God, I was dead. But the good thing is the baby is now sleeping. I've recovered, and we're moving on. But anyway, it's about moving on. It's about the athletics season. It's now athletics. And it's not everyone's cup of tea, but we do like a bit of athletics. And it's now started last week. Sorry, Thursday, Friday night, they had the first Diamond League meeting. So it's kind of kick-started the programme. For a lot of you listeners that probably come in from an endurance background, would have run cross-country track and all that sort of cross-country and road. Now's the time you kind of be looking at a bit of speed. And Jermaine, as a speed demon yourself, what was May all about? What was May all about for you? What were you doing in this part of the year to get yourself ready for the track?
So May for the top guy, like April, May would be going to training camps.
Yeah.
And then, so you'll come back mid-May. So off warm weather altitude.
Yeah.
And then, because obviously it's easier to do speed there.
Yeah.
Because the weather has been reasonably good so far, but usually the weather's like, it's not warm enough because you have to start doing faster sessions.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's easier with warmer weather.
Yeah.
So yeah, the transition would be like, you start taking longer recovery and doing quicker sessions, but unless obviously less distance.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But you wouldn't be, and would then, you still be in the gym and stuff now?
I'm reducing gym. So okay. Obviously if you was doing it twice a week, I'd do it once a week. If you do it once a week, you do it like, I would say half time, but you just go there and you don't lift as much.
Okay.
So you just do it for the motion.
Okay. Yeah. Even at this stage and now, then, even right months before your big event.
Yeah. You just start tapering down because obviously you want to start getting fresher.
Yeah,
because if you need to run faster, you need to be a bit fresher.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's different just doing stodge, and you can just churn it out when you're just doing the endurance. You need to be a bit more nippy.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And obviously you got to be careful because this is the time when everyone starts putting their spikes on from just running in trainers all year. So usually you get calf and Achilles problems and stuff. So it's like transition of like doing half your session in trainers and then quickly swapping into spikes at the end. Just to get your, you know, like the bottom half of your legs used to running on your toes and stuff.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So what would, like, for a 1500 metre man, or for, I suppose you're doing more 3K stuff, but what would your sessions look like now then? If you were out for a track session, you wouldn't be doing, like, 2400s. What would you be doing?
It'd be down to 10-4s.
Okay.
It'd be down to 10-4s, yeah. And you'd be going off a minute. Yeah. And then if you're doing Ks, maybe 5-6 times a K.
Yeah.
But as it goes on, it goes like 4 times a K, and then you're taking 3 minutes, 5 minutes break.
Okay, yeah. And you'd be going you'd be going hard there. You'd be 85%.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Like a classic session in the summer is definitely 10 times 400 off a minute.
Yeah.
And then if you can get as close as you can to 60 or sub 60, for obviously really far, that's the classic summer session.
Okay, yeah. The classic. I don't think I've ever run a 60 second 400.
I remember I was in South Africa and I did a session with Noah Nguyen.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Year he beat the year he beat Olgaroosh,
wow,
in the final.
Yeah.
And they were doing like 15 400s. And me and my friend James Connor was like, okay, we're joining. So everyone joined in. Whiteman was there,
yeah.
Spate. And we had to do it. We had to do 3 400s and miss one.
Yeah.
But they were running sub 60s. Easy.
Oh.
They were just doing 56s, 50. I was like, what?
Off a minute rest.
Yeah.
Oof, Jesus. Wow.
Flying.
Yeah, that is something else. But hey, I'm never going to be able to experience that, but we'll see.
But what sort of stuff did you do for the summer? Because obviously I know you wasn't really a summer specialist, but you still had to get ready for the summer.
Yeah, well, when I was running all right on the track, I was doing that, because I went down to run with Ken when I ran 14:20. So I would be doing similar things like you said then. So K's, six times a K with 4 minutes recovery and going pretty good. Looks like you'd be going, you know, definitely sub three. You'd be trying to get down to maybe even 2:40 something. And that was, I was running, yeah, well then.
Huh? Low 240s, because obviously, yeah, you'd be aiming for low 240s. Yeah.
So that was a good one. The problem with me is, and the problem why I didn't probably run well on the track, because I never really had that much variation between the two seasons. So I'd still be doing a big mileage, reasonable mileage. I'd still keep doing like a 10 miler most days, and then, you know, track, and I'd still be doing a jog in the morning before the track and stuff, and doubling all that sort of thing. So I think the reason why I never really got much faster is, one, that I'm not that gifted, I'm not that quick, but also I didn't really have that variation. And I wouldn't, you saying there about the you planning your whole year, so you do your gym and your weights in the winter and then you'd ease back through the summer. I'd never really think about that. Do you know what I mean? I just almost do the same gym all the way through the year, a couple of weeks before ease off. So I was never really that, you know, focused enough to have enough zip for the track. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But talking about, you said you're not that talented, like, in terms of spin.
Yeah.
You took a... didn't
you, recently? Oh, yeah, that they took a DNA test. Yeah, that's coming. That is coming next week. So I'll reveal to everyone what happened.
The results.
Yeah, well, we'll talk you through the whole process of what happened. So I did do a DNA test with Tom Lancashire.
It's a DNA fitness test.
Yeah, they're called.
I did a DNA test to see my heritage recently.
Yeah.
You've done a DNA fitness test.
Yeah, where are you from? Where's your heritage from?
I don't know,
yeah.
It takes 6 weeks for the results, so I'll let you know in a couple of weeks.
Is he from Jamaica? Is he from Mongolia?
I'm a Jafakan. What are you talking about?
But with me, I know the results. So it told me about my diet. It told me about kind of the genes that I have and what I'm receptive to. So it was really interesting, but we will do a whole show on it. But it was quite shocking to me that actually I am receptive to speed, but I just need to train it. So maybe listening to what you were saying, I'm 36 now, so that ship's probably sailed, but I could have potentially if I'd...
No, you're still young enough. Look at all that you said, like Nick Torrey's.
Yeah.
He's doing all that.
Nick Torrey, Paul Martelletti's getting on a bit. He's still running 2:16 for the marathon. But yeah.
But that's still long distance stuff. That's not track.
That's
but, yeah.
distance stuff, yeah, yeah. And if you look at Kipchoge, you're not sure how old he might... I mean, Gabby Selassie was 40-year-old when he ran 2:03, so it's different, isn't it? Different kind of ball game. But I'd like to see if I could still run a decent 10K time, decent 5K. So
on track.
Maybe I need to concentrate a bit more on that and try.
Maybe we should target Nightly Athletics next year.
Okay. All right, then. Let's do that. Next year.
Next year.
Both of us.
Next year, Nightly Athletics. Because this year we're doing a show there, aren't we?
We hopefully nail that down. I've got a reply to Ben. But we should be doing that. But next year... Let's get that sorted. Let's aim for me and you at least sub 30-30.
Yeah. Okay, I know I've got fancy dress in my head, but imagine we turn up for Ben Poacher won't be happy.
We better check the
ground.
We're
saying, Ben, we're trying to spice it up for you, Ben. We're trying to spice it up.
Sub 30 in a wearing just a detail.
Ben, isn't it being on the news with world record in a fancy dress on a track at the British 10K Championships? It'd be all over everywhere.
Unfortunately, man, the mainstream media, that's probably true. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, BBC, like you say, Big Ben gets on BBC and Eliud Kipchoge barely does, but hey. Ben, one thing we've got, before we our interview this week, we're going to talk about the track. So we want to talk to Irish journalist, Cathal Denhenny. I hope I've said Denhenny right. And he's going to talk to us about the Semenya case that's just dropped this ruling from the CAS, Court of Arbitration of Sport, that's obviously come down against Semenya. So we're going to talk to him about that ruling. But before that, we've actually got a quick interview with Mark Lloyd. So Mark Lloyd is the winner of our Sore Running Grassroots Hero Award. So we're going to please well done to Mark. We're going to talk a little bit about his role at Cottage, which is a group in London. And he's going to tell us all about that. And I'll put him on now. And with Carl, we'll come in straight afterwards. Here we go. On today's show, we are talking to the Sore Running Grassroots Hero winner, Mark Lloyd. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Sean. Thank you very much indeed.
No problem. And congratulations. How did you find out that Bethany nominated you?
Well, Bethany told me that I'd won. I had no idea that she'd nominated me. Yeah. And then she sent me a message and said I was the winner of this. And I thought it was very nice of her because, there aren't as many women as men in our group. And I'm pleased that she appreciates the efforts that I make. And it's nice to get a little bit of recognition.
Fantastic. And you're an integral part of it's Cottage Group in London.
The story of Cottage was founded really by Phil O'Dell.
Right.
And Phil O'Dell is a coach. He was involved with Bedford. Mm. And he had a tiny group up in Bedford for a while, which included Nielsen Hall and Matt James. And they used to meet at his house, which they called the Cottage, which was, it's because of the Lauriston Cottage. It was a famous distance running destination in London. And so they called their group the Cottage there. Yeah. And then when Nielsen moved to London and a few other people moved to London, Phil decided to relocate Cottage, and it became Cottage Relocated. And it's based in Battersea. And at that point, this is probably about 2016, Phil, who I'd known for a few years, asked me if I wanted to get involved with helping and supporting him and sort of run the London group as much as possible. And that's essentially what happened. So Phil is my mentor in many ways. He's a great friend of mine now, but he's hugely experienced. And I'm not as experienced, but I learn from him. I talk to him. We work together very closely. But because he lives in Bedford, he's also involved with coaching at Cambridge. I'm the face of things in Battersea Park in London. And I'm the one that's there every week. And I'm the one that sort of deals with individuals on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
But Phil is behind it all. I wouldn't want to. So it's very nice to get recognition. But Phil is very much part of it.
Yeah.
We talk every Monday. Review what's been going on over the weekend, and then work out what we're going to do in the coming week. I wouldn't be as winning an award like this if it wasn't for Phil's help.
Yes. And you just, obviously, with 2 weeks ago, it was the London Marathon, or even less than that, a week and a half ago. How many guys did you have running there in London this year?
I think we had about 15 or 16 of the group. I mean, the group ethos is that even if you move away, we still consider you to be Cottage.
Right. So you've got Cottage blood flowing for your...
So Andrew Lawrence has gone back to Morpeth, for example, but he's still... Chris Oddie's moved to Yorkshire, but he's still Cottage, you know. Yeah. I think, Nick Torrey's been down over the winter quite a lot. So he was essentially our first runner home, I think, 2016, wasn't he?
Yeah, fantastic.
Then we had Alex Milne, Bilal Ahmed, who ran really well.
Yeah.
Dan Gaffney, Andy Greenleaf, Chris Oddie, James Ellis, a triathlete, 226. Wow. Xavier Gruot, 227. Ben Goddard had a great run, 231. Rich Ollington, do you know the guy who, did you ever see the film with the picture of the guy leading at the front, in pink shorts?
Oh, yes, Did he finish?
With Eliud Kipchoge?
Yeah. He
finished in two, he ran 234.
No.
25, Richard Ollington. Yeah, so he's Cottage. Yeah. Yeah, James Tidd, 238. Andrew Lawrence, 238. Steph McCall, 251. We had, lots of people out there.
Fantastic.
And so for our perspective as sort of spectators, and it was brilliant fun because apart from after the sort of super elite groups, it was that we had somebody almost in every group.
Yeah.
So Phil and I were racing around on our bikes, jumping up and down, shouting at people.
Great.
We had a great day out. But as I said to some of the guys, they're the ones that do all the hard work.
Yeah. And it's not actually an athletics club, is it? You're club agnostic, you mentioned to me.
Yeah, no, we're definitely club agnostic. No, it's we're not a club. We have no intention of becoming a club. We're just sort of a group of like-minded people, I guess. It's a, I mean, I think Cottage works as a place for good athletes to train together once a week in London. People come to London after university. They need somewhere to train. And I'm talking, you know, this is people who can run 14, 15 minutes for 5K. Are good. And they've come from all sorts of clubs. And so we don't mind what clubs they're from. And we also, you know, we work with other coaches. We're not trying to take over people. You know, people, we're very, very open about what we do.
Yeah.
So, you know, athletes come down and they're coached by, you know, so Luke Caldwell will come down, for example, and he's coached by Alan Storys, I think, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
But that, you know, and he just joins in the sessions. And, you know, I've known Mark Hookway for years. So, and Ryan Driscoll, one of his athletes, comes down. Chris Ollie used to come down before he went to America.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and we'll tell people what we're doing. We, as I say, are very open.
Yeah.
If anybody asks me what club to join, I tell them it's up to them.
Okay.
There's a big, there's a very social group of Hercules Wimbledon within Cottage.
Yeah. Okay.
Freddie Slemek is, and Bilal Ahmed are very, very pro Hercules. So they're constantly recruiting. And there's obviously a big Serpentine group, but there's also a big Thames Valley Harriers group as well. There's people from all over. Yeah. All over London. And of course, if we operate out of Battersea, there, it's easy for people to get to after work.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a group that runs down from St. Paul's as part of their warm-up.
Yeah.
And people run in from wherever their offices are.
I've just seen Eliud Kipchoge, he's announced that he's going to be trying to do the sub 2 hours again. And it's been run from London. So it looks like it's going to be in London. I think Battersea is probably the ideal place to do it. Get him doing laps around there.
Yeah, to be honest. Yeah, and it gets, I think it's a brilliant park actually for training and racing because it's very well protected.
Okay.
Notwithstanding, it's very close to the river.
Yeah.
It's rarely, rarely windy.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially in the evenings. Yeah.
Let's start that campaign.
Presumably, Well, he was in Battersea Park, wasn't he? I think last week.
Oh, he might have been.
There's some, and one of the guys, there's a couple of pictures, I think, on, yeah, one of the guys bumped into him in Battersea Park. I don't know what he's doing there.
Scoping it out,
yeah.
So I want to talk a bit about your beginnings of involvement in sports. When did you get involved with running?
When I was about 13.
Yeah.
So I got involved with running at school, and I was a member of Tunbridge AC as a young athlete.
Yeah.
And I ran. So yeah, I ran through school. I think I ran my PB 1500 when I was about 16, getting battered by Mark Rowland, which dates me. But that was he was quite good.
Yeah.
But I'm one of those people that went off to university and decided that it was far too much like hard work.
Okay.
I went to Leeds in about 1981, and there was a guy called Jeff Turnbull there. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
And I decided I'd never be that good, so I virtually stopped.
Really?
I stopped then. And then I came back to it again a bit later on when I ran a couple of marathons.
Yeah.
But I kept getting injured. And then I moved to cycling for a bit.
Ah.
I started mountain bike racing.
Yeah.
Sort of in my late 20s, which was a new sport. And I thought that was quite similar in terms of that's an endurance sport. And I enjoyed that. So I have quite a close relationship with cycling.
Yeah.
And then when my son was about 13 or 14, he decided he wanted to run. And I've always been very wary of the under 13 age group. I think that you start when you're under 13, the chance of you doing it when you're under 23 are limited sometimes.
Right.
You know, it's just too long.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that I have a sort of whole idea that people should do as many sports as they can.
Yeah.
As long as they can.
Yeah.
Football, rugby, tennis, whatever you want, swimming, you know, it's all good. But he, when he was 14, he decided to run. He joined Herne-Hill Harriers because that's our local club.
Yeah.
And I remember going to the Southerns. The Southerns were held that year at Parliament Hill and having this weird experience where I bumped into Mark Hookway and I thought, I haven't seen him for, you know, 25 years. And all the Tunbridge AC sort of the coaches were the people I'd run with.
Oh, really?
Years and years before.
Yeah.
And so, yes, then Lewis started running. So, we've had a sort of for the last 10 years or so, that's been an interesting an experience.
Yeah.
His ups and downs with the sport.
Yeah.
And I've kept, you know, always kept in touch with endurance sport, and I've always, I had a bad skiing accident about 15 years ago, and so I was told never to run again.
Really?
And so then I had to get on a bike and start racing bikes.
Okay.
I like this stuff. So I've done a fair bit of cycling as well.
Yeah.
But I've now abandoned my cycling racing career anyway, because middle-aged men and cycle racing are a strange breed, I decided. But if you hang out with the boys, people at Cottage, you realise that they're doing proper sport. I've moved much more towards the coaching.
Yeah. Level.
Although I like to rock up at events on my bike.
Because your son's, he was seventh at the National Cross last year, was that right?
Lewis has had a few interesting experiences. He can run sometimes. He went to the World Cross in 2013.
Wow.
He was in the under 20 team.
Yeah.
So he's had some quite good experiences through the sport.
How involved are you in his coaching? Do you coach him directly, or do you kind of hands off and let someone else to deal with that?
No, I coach him. I coach him directly.
Right.
Phil is very helpful because Lewis was at Cambridge with Phil, and Phil is very good.
Yeah.
And I talk to Phil about it, but yeah, I help him. Although it's awkward coaching your son, as anybody who's coached a child will know, is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
But it kind of works for us.
Yeah,
And it means we're still good friends, actually, which is you probably might find surprising. But we get on very well when it comes to running, anyway.
Yeah.
And you'll know what it's. There's always ups and downs. It's never straightforward.
Yeah,
this running lark, is it?
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
It's not a bad metaphor. I've always thought, as a parent, it's not a bad metaphor for life.
Yeah,
you know, you get the ups and downs of it. What happens? You have to deal with. You know, you have to deal with disappointments as well as, you know, when things are going well.
Yeah. And also you get out what you put in. The more effort you give, the more focus you give, the better it pays off, the dedication you show. Within
Absolutely.
Reason.
Yeah.
Within
I mean, reason. And that's one of the I think that's one of the reasons why I love the sport myself. Exactly that.
Yeah.
You know? And that's when you see people do get their rewards.
Yeah.
It's a great satisfaction. And you do, you know, yes. And I think sometimes people can overdo it.
Yeah.
And that's part of the balance, isn't it? We're all trying to manage our lives. Lives are difficult.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you're at the level of the Cottage people,
yeah,
you know, they've often got very good jobs as well, demanding jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you're trying to run well, and you're trying to live your life as well and have relationships and things. And you think there's a lot going on there. If you're 25 or 26 years old and you're very, you know, quite ambitious to do okay at work, and you want to run well, and you want to have a relationship with a boy, you know, a partner or something. Yeah, there's not a lot of time for anything else.
No, absolutely.
Difficult stuff, which is why I've got, you know, huge admiration for all these young people, and why I enjoy it so much, I think, because it's like, if they're committed that much, then, you know, why wouldn't I be?
Well, great. Well, congratulations for the award, and thanks for all the work you're putting in there in at the Cottage, and hope it all continues. And I'll have to come down for a session one day. Next time I'm back in London, I'll try and...
More than welcome.
Yeah, although these days, I don't know if I'll be able to hang on.
Yeah, well, that's the challenge. You'll find yourself getting nervous in the afternoon before a Cottage session. Which isn't what should be happening. But yes, as some people say, yes, they sort of live in... Yes, you have that anxiety hanging over you on this Tuesday. God, it's training tonight. But as I say, you'll be welcome at any time.
Great stuff. Well, thanks, Mark. Thanks very much for chatting. On the phone this evening is Cathal Dennehy. How are you doing, Cole?
Very good, Sean. Thank you for having me on.
Great stuff. And you're a freelance sports journalist.
Yeah, so I'm a freelancer, studied journalism, was a former runner. And then once I gave up on those dreams, I went into journalism as a different approach to try and stay in the sport I loved, which is athletics and the sport of running. And I've been freelancing now for about 5-6 years for, I suppose, a variety of outlets like Irish newspapers and Runner's World and IWF and whoever will give me a book, basically.
Okay, yeah. We've had in the last couple of days a huge controversy about the Casus Menia CAS, Court of Arbitration of Sport, a ruling. And obviously she's failed her appeal to against that. It's been a bit of a controversial, been a bit of a busy day on social media, I guess, in the world of sports journalism.
Yeah, certainly. I think anyone who weighed it in with an honest opinion on social media probably was regretting it quite quickly. I was probably one of those at one point when you get involved in the tangled mess, and even when you try to stay relatively polite and impartial, there's all sorts of insults been flung around on social media over the past week, which criticism is fine, I think, regardless either of the regulations or of DSD athletes being allowed to compete. I think criticism is always okay either way, once it comes from a foundation of having read both sides of the story and read the research and what it says. But there was a lot of what you could only describe as ignorant rhetoric on social media last week, and in both directions you see ridiculous comments coming in from just so insensitive to Caster Semenya herself, and then on the flip side, many Caster Semenya supporters, which I'm sure she would not endorse in any way because she's always handled herself with such class, just slinging abuse at people like Joanna Jozwik of Poland and Lindsay Sharp of Britain, you know, who basically, you know, people were dragging up interviews they did 3 years ago at the Rio Olympics where Lindsay Sharp started crying in an interview. And like, if you look at what she actually said, it's basically just that it's a hard situation and people can see for themselves how hard it is for us. Which is a very fair comment from someone who had, as the evidence shows, been denied an Olympic medal by athletes with DSD, which if these regulations were brought in one Olympic cycle earlier, Lindsay Sharp would be an Olympic medalist. Yeah. So you can see how difficult it is also for them. But she detailed in Doha last Friday that she'd been given death threats on social media and against her family because of that interview 3 years ago. And if you read the comments, one particularly disturbing thread was in Riyat Al Samurai of the Daily Mail when he tweeted that Lindsay Sharp had been given death threats. About 300 comments underneath were just basically insulting her and saying, just making complete light of the fact that it was also difficult for her. There is. And then again, on the flip side, people who are reasonably arguing that it might be unfair for DSD athletes to be in competing against other women, that's a fine thing to say once it's well backed up by research. However, a lot of people were coming in with just foolish comments. You know, I'm sure everyone will have seen them if you spent enough time on Twitter. Things like Semenya is a man. Yeah. You know, just completely lack of any nuance or understanding of the sort of how much of a gray area it is. Yeah. And really, I think in the world of sport, we've never dealt with a grey area quite so grey as this, quite so hazy, in that there is no right answer, as Court of Arbitration for Sport acknowledged last weekend. You know, it's unfair to Semenya and other DSD athletes, and the previous setup of recent years was also unfair to their rivals.
Yeah.
And the question really going forward is, who deserves to lose out? And Court of Arbitration for Sport, by a vote of 2-1, which in itself says a lot about this, that even they could not agree unanimously on the best approach going forward. They argued that it's the minority, the Caster Semenya and other DSD athletes, who should lose out. Basically, the 0.1% will lose out to protect the integrity of competition for the other 99.9%.
Yeah. So what exactly was the ruling? What's been decided?
So the IWF were told back in 2015 when the regulations to suppress testosterone were originally suspended, Cass said, you need to show us evidence that DSD athletes benefit from this advantage due to their increased testosterone.
Yeah. And so what, for those who don't know, DSD is...
Sorry, DSD is differences of sexual development, right. which is a kind of an umbrella term. And again, you'll have seen this a lot recently because the language has kind of changed in recent years. You know, originally people were using the term intersex, which is kind of too specific a term that doesn't cover the umbrella. And then hyperandrogenism was used, but then that was shelved in favor of DSD, which is kind of an umbrella term that takes in a very wide span of complex conditions when people can have just irregular, I suppose, developments when it comes to their genetics. So you have different chromosomes, different combinations of male and female sex organs, conditions like polycystic ovary, you know, and just basically, it's an umbrella term to cover a lot of different ways that irregular development can happen biologically, for men and women. So DSD athletes, and the condition, I suppose, we've most become familiar with in recent weeks, it's the chromosome, it's 46SY DSD is actually the very specific branch that is of athletes that is being, I guess, targeted here or covered by these regulations. And so the IAAF decided that testosterone regulation would be the fairest way of leveling the advantage they have, because the majority of these DSD athletes were born with male sex organs. And by that, I mean testes, which for anyone who was even the basic, like myself, understanding of biology from the school days, you know that once you hit puberty, the presence of testes in your body sends your testosterone levels through the roof. So there's not obviously not much difference. Anyone who has a son or daughter, younger brother or sister would have noticed this, you know, when boys and girls are playing sport up to about the age of 11 or 12, there's not too much difference in strength and speed and power. But biologically, if you have testes, once you hit puberty, they send your testosterone. It's literally a natural course of anabolic steroids for your body.
Yeah.
So really, men and women thereafter will never be able to be competitive. On the average, of course, obviously you have outliers either way.
Yeah.
So there's about a 10 to 12% difference in performance then in sport thereafter, after puberty. And these athletes were born with testes, which not all of them, but the majority of them are born with testes, which the normal female range for testosterone is between 0.1 and 1.7 nanomoles per liter of testosterone in the body. And the male, so 0.1 to 1.7, and then the male range for testosterone because of testes is between 7 and 29. So it's about 20 times the average man has about 20 times the average woman in terms of testosterone levels in the body. And the DSD athletes who are targeted are all in the male range because of the presence of testes. Generally, obviously not every situation, but that's generally the case. So the IAAF decided that if they have, whether it's partially or fully male biology, and obviously we know it's partially male biology, that the best way to equalize that advantage would be for them to take what is basically equivalent to the birth control pill to regulate their hormones and lower those testosterone levels down into the female range. It's not quite the limit they said. Obviously, I said it's 1.7 is the like 99% of women are below 1.7. They set the cutoff at 5 nanomoles. So it's below the male range, but it's halfway between the male and the female range. So it's not quite to bring it back. And that's the cover to allow certain conditions basically of high testosterone and disorders. But most experts, and even when this was in place, the empirical evidence would tend to suggest as much, that when these athletes are taking this medication, that their performances regress quite substantially. You'll have seen it doesn't take a genius to, you can look at Caster Semenya's annual progression. Ross Tucker, the South African sports scientist, estimates that it's about 7 seconds over 800 meters is the effect on performance. So you're talking about 154, 155, 156 athletes suddenly becoming 201, 202, 203, whereby they're, I guess they are still competitive. They might be in a Diamond League or in some of these major championship semifinals and finals, but you're certainly not, they're certainly not going to be winning if that's how they regress, which I think most people would expect that they will in the coming years.
And just to kind of a final thought is, it's part of almost in a way of a more active kind of involvement in athletics in a way. In like they're more sort of Sebco and his administration seems to be more keen to get involved with, obviously with the banning of Russia, and they seem to be more interventionist, let's say, in their direction of athletics. Do you think that, you know, that they're trying to make a fair platform, trying to engineering more of an interest, engineering more of a trust in top level sport? And is it going to work? That's a massive question.
Yeah, I think they're certainly attempting to. I think even the staunchest critic of the IAAF would probably have to concede in recent years that they've made huge headway in terms of doping compared to what went on in the previous regime under Lamine Diak. Mm. And the Athletics Integrity Unit has now... So IAAF previously, anti-doping was something that was run in-house by a unit that had communication from the president and had an interference, I suppose, from the highest levels in the past. But now, since they set up the Athletics Integrity Unit, it's become a completely independent body. David Howman, the former head of World Anti-Doping Agency, is now head of the Athletics Integrity Unit. Mm. And really, you just need to see the rate of positive tests to show that there's certainly... doing a good job at rooting out doping in the sport. There's a huge amount of Kenyans have tested positive in recent years. And again, it's, you can see by the...
Kiptum was just before the London Marathon. That was an amazing the timing of that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's 3 Kenyans have failed tests for the biological passport this year. And they've caught dozens and dozens in recent years. And not just Kenyans, they've caught people from all around the world. Mm. And they've really done a good job at bolstering the testing regimes in countries that were previously quite negligent, either through choice or through lack of resources, whether that be places like Jamaica or Ethiopia or Kenya that maybe just didn't have robust anti-doping systems. So those have certainly improved in recent years. Are they perfect? No. They'll never be perfect and they'll never catch all the cheats, and specifically the high-level cheats who have huge resources behind them and have very sophisticated programs to get away with it. And the testing, even David Howman in recent days said that it was stuck in the 1970s in a sense, and that they need to explore new scientific methods to try and catch the cheats. I think the sport has certainly improved. You can never be sure about these things because a lot of times, you know, I'm sure in 2000 and 2005, people probably at the time thought, oh, our sport is getting better. We're relatively clean. Now we look back at those times now and realize it was filthy. You know, you just need to look at the amount of people who've tested positive retroactively and the amount of associations that people had who were being coached by certain coaches who came from certain countries who were on the podiums. So there is a chance, I think, we look back at this era and go, oh, of course, how did we not know that such and such was taking drugs? It's so obvious now in hindsight. But my sense is certainly at the moment when I watch athletics that I'm watching a far cleaner sport than I was watching 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Is it clean? No, of course not. But it will never be 100% clean. And, you know, I think I would widen that to all major sports, whether it's football, whether it's cycling, whether it's boxing.
Yeah.
They're all with such rewards on the line and such emphasis based on physical performance and the importance of strength, power, speed. Any sport where you have that, you're going to have a reasonably chunky percentage of people who decide to cheat. And that's the way it is in athletics, and that's something. But is it getting better? I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. And on a light-hearted note, do you think, looking, obviously the Diamond League started last night, is there anything you're excited, only one you're excited about, or an event you're excited about going forward into the World Championships this year that you think we should watch out for?
Yeah, there's lots. So we had a good Diamond League opening the other night. Helen O'Beery versus Ginzeba Dibaba was a fantastic race at 3,000 metres. Dina Asher-Smith was absolutely rocking it in the 200 metres, just about half a mile ahead of everyone.
Yeah.
And then even in the field events... Daniel Stahl was outstanding through over 70 meters twice, I think it was, which was outstanding. And Ryan Krauser continues to dominate and may even, who knows, put the world record under threat in the men's shot, but as well in the coming months. But I suppose distance running bias simmering to the surface once again. I'm hugely excited to see the men's 1500 this year. I think Jacob Inge-Britsen is coming up and is a rising force. And you have an interesting... I guess family rivalry there between Elijah Maningoy, who is world champion and I guess the best 1500 meter runner in the world at the moment, as he showed again the other night with victory over Timothy Chariot. But then you also have his younger brother, George Maningoy. And George Maningoy, the younger brother, is the world youth champion, and he's the world's, so he's world under 18 champion and world under 20 champion. And of course, one of the people he beat last year in those world under 20 championships was Jacob Inge-Britsen. And meanwhile, Jacob's older brother, Philip Inge-Britsen, finished third behind Elijah Maningoy George's older brother at the last World Championships. So right now it's kind of 2-0 to the Menengoys at major championships over the Ingebrigtsen brothers, younger and older brothers. But I think we know the Ingebrigtsens will be a strong force in the years ahead. So that's what I'm really looking forward to. Like, wouldn't it be wonderful to see? And George Menengoy, the youngster, set a PB of 3:34 there the other night in Doha. Wow. He was down the field in 6th or 7th. But I will say this, having spoken to him myself, people are very skeptical about Kenyon's ages. He does strike you as a very young, like, both in looks, in terms of the way he talks and everything, as a genuine teenager.
Yeah.
So I suppose my dream scenario would be looking ahead to Doha to see both George Menengoy and Elijah Menengoy in final for Kenya. And then you have Philip Ingebrigtsen, Henrik Ingebrigtsen and Jacob Ingebrigtsen in there for Norway, and just have this absolute family feud playing out on the global stage. It would be a fantastic intriguing battle to see how that tactically would play out. But that's excellent. One event, I suppose. And another event like the steeplechase, again, distance running bias, but I'm hugely excited to see the steeplechase. Consensus Caputo has been unbeatable, but he had an ankle injury the other night.
Yeah.
And that was a cracker of an event last year. And with Evan Jaeger coming back and El Bakkali in Morocco.
Yeah.
And who knows, coming out of Kenya with that production line of champions that they have, that'll be another great event to watch this year. And others like the women's 400 meters, Shauna Miller-Weibo, who started the season in outstanding form.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since anyone has run low 48 seconds or obviously under 48 seconds in the 400 meters. But if there's any athlete of this generation who's going to do it, it's going to be Shauna Miller-Weibo. So I'll be intrigued to see what she has to do. And obviously we've got the World Relays coming up in Japan this weekend in Yokohama, just outside Tokyo. So that'll be an interesting gauge as well, to see who's running well. It's always a bit of fun. It's never taken too seriously. And there's qualifying spots on the line for the World Championships. So that'll give us a good indication of who's fighting fit at this early stage of the season.
Great. I'm just trying to wrap my brains for a British hope, but we haven't really got many, really. Depending on whether Mo goes back to the track, but even then, I don't think he's necessarily going to dominate in the way he used to. But anyway, there's plenty more to look forward to rather than just British athletes, I think.
Exactly, yeah. And like I said, Dean Asher-Smith will be a force to be reckoned with on the track anyway. And obviously, you've Katrina Johnson-Thompson as well. Oh, sorry, Laura Muir in terms of distance races.
Oh, yes,
she'll be extremely hard to stop. I guess... In the absence of Faith Kipyegon, who took last year off to have a baby, the 2017 World 1500 meter champion, I guess it was either Laura Muir or Shelby Houlihan, the American, with a fearsome kick, who are probably dominating that event. All evidence, I think Shelby Houlihan was beaten indoors, and I think she had a couple of injury problems. And Laura Muir only kicked on. She was unbelievably good in winning that double at the European Indoor Championships. So I think right now, if you were to pick the most likely Olympic champion in the women's 1500 in Tokyo or Doha this year, you would probably pick Laura Muir, and she has that endurance base where she can also step up the 5000.
Yeah.
So I'd be intrigued to see what Laura Muir does. I think she's the kind of athlete who could well run like a 3:53 or so, or who knows, maybe even a 3:52 1500 this year. The world record is probably still a bit out of reach for her, but she's only going forward, and she's becoming, with experience, she's becoming a lot more tactically astute as well. Absolutely. So she's going to be a really tough nut to crack this year.
Yeah, excellent. You managed to make me excited. I wasn't excited before, but now I am excited. So thanks, Carl. You certainly made me look forward to it. Yeah.
I hope it's not false hope, Sean. That's all I'll say.
Excellent. Well, I better leave you to your day. You're off in San Francisco enjoying the weather, so I'll let you go and enjoy yourself, and I'll get back to looking after the baby and making sure she doesn't wake up tonight. But thanks for chatting.
Thank you very much, Sean. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Good stuff. Cheers, Carl. So nice couple of interviews there. Nice to hear Carl's thoughts on Semenya case and Aflex going forward through the summer. We should talk to reviews. So, we haven't had reviews for a long time, have we?
Must be stacking up. What we got, like, 3?
Well, we've had lots of ratings. We've only had one written review, so we need more. Perhaps we're not reading them out enough. But we've had one from Baz from Basingstoke.
I do, yeah. The fat boy from Basingstoke. I know him, yeah. Yeah. He rolls around. Pointing his finger over his stopwatch. Yeah, I know him.
Yeah. And Baz says, keep up the good work, guys. That's the title. And he says, great show, love the format. I have to say there, the greatest endurance achievement has to be Laze Viren, 1972, 10,000 meter Olympic final.
He was tripped after 12 laps. He got back to the pack, worked his way to the front, broke the world, won the gold, and broke the world record, which is a good shout, I think, Lasse Virran. And also, I think Lasse, was he Finnish, right?
Yeah, he's from Finland, yeah.
So he would have worn my favourite brand of running trainers. Kahus. Have you seen these? So like they're not running trainers now. They were running trainers back then. But they make these like they used to make handmade running shoes. They're really nice. Like they're now like just like fashion shoes. But I've got two pairs. They're amazing. They're really nice. And they invented the air bubble. This company.
What, Nike bought it off them?
Nike bought it off them. And also, again, they invented the three stripe and Adidas bought it off them.
Oh, boy.
So this company, if you're a real running fan, you should be sporting Kahus. I'm angling for a sponsorship, but they don't give them out. But anyway, I'd love a sponsorship.
Well, to get a sponsorship, first you have to be a good runner.
Yeah, I know. I'm missing that one. But I do like wearing them around the house. So, yeah, anyway. But that's that. Nice to chat, Jermaine. I'll leave you on your bank holiday to enjoy the sights of Basingstoke. What are the sights, by the way? KFC?
Don't worry. When they see you, they're going to get you with their pitchforks.
Date where I'm from, boy, we have double sized pitchforks. Yeah. I'm a Southwest boy, anyway. Yeah. Anyway, I'll leave you to your bank holiday. Let's speak next week.
Bye. See ya. Bye.
Bye.